For when you used all the goals on day one and you have none for the rest of the knockout round, it's That's So MLS. North American Soccer Podcast with myself, Andrew Bates, and Nick Thornton.
Hey, it's me. When you've used all the what?
Goals.
Goals. Oh, okay. That makes more sense now. I'm sorry. I think I just killed it. I didn't hear properly.
Do you want to do it again, or is this good?
No, I think this is perfect. This is a good insight into how I don't fucking pay attention to things. And, great! Welcome!
We had a knockout round where, there was a huge fucking bushel of goals.
There was only nine.
The Whitecaps somehow scoring five on the San Jose Earthquakes, in New York scoring four in Chicago. And then nothing.
Yeah.
For like 210 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. So I'd just like to point out that I believe I did not actually go back and listen or pay that much attention when I was making the predictions for how the playoff knockout rounds would shape up. But I do believe I said it would be 3-2 for somebody, Vancouver versus San Jose. Which I'd like to point out I wasn't technically wrong. It's just that the 3-2 result ended up being five goals for Vancouver, which is like, nobody's gonna predict that ever.
You got the total goals right. It's true.
I got the total goals right. I'm gonna run with that.
Yes. So those two things happened. We've also had the first two games, two of the games of the first of the next round.
Mm-hmm.
Houston Portland is happening as we speak, and we're keeping our eye on that. But due to timelines in time zones, we can't wait anymore to bring you this great soccer discussion.
Yeah, and I should note, I mean, by the time we air this, the game will be done, but Houston just won a penalty kick in the 30th minute. Literally, just right now that happened, and they haven't taken it yet, I don't think. So, but anyway, that's not important, because if you had the misfortune of watching the Houston Kansas City game, holy God, bit of a snoozer.
We've had the opportunity to really compare types of 0-0 draws over the last week.
We certainly have. There's been a number of them. Which is actually kind of the thing you might have expected. I mean, of course, you wouldn't expect a 0-0 draw in the knockout round, because that's not allowed. But I don't think anybody could have expected, and I kind of want to talk about New York first.
New York-Chicago, or New York, the one that we just had?
New York-Chicago. And I know this is happening a little bit after the fact for people, but I think it will help maybe contextualize where we are. I know it's the playoffs, anything can happen, it doesn't really matter because it's over two legs, and yeah, it's a whole thing. But I really don't think anybody could have predicted that Chicago would have just capitulated so poorly. Well, I guess capitulated very well, because they really, really gave up their chance. And I don't know, I was wondering what your thoughts were from a Chicago side that's been electric for much of the season, and we know what Schweinsteiger's brought to the group. We knew that he wasn't available, but what were your thoughts on that? I mean, New York Red Bulls have been up and down and all over the place, but they really, really looked very, very comfortable in that win, and it's not just the old adage of the goal line doesn't reflect the full story. I feel like this is one of those matches where it really does. New York really wasn't troubled by Chicago at all and put on a all-star performance.
Well, I think that we talked a little bit last week about how the fact of the matchup between Chicago and New York was really going to base in New York's case whether or not their stars could perform and up to their whether or not the Stars could perform up to the standard that we expect of them. And in Chicago's, it was more about balance, which is something they, I think, lacked in the run-up. The team did not really seem to be able to make things work. There was another big blow-up in the last week of the season, and you can't always look at the last week of a season when players are being rested. Mm-hmm. But I think that without Schweinsteiger as like a key part of the lineup, and without that sort of momentum, they really weren't able to get anything going. In a game where every New York player, key star from Kleston to Bradley Wright Phillips, were able to score, it seemed when I was watching it that every Chicago player had a major whiff.
Yeah.
All their keys, Nikolic, Akam, there were a lot from the, I believe it was a disallowed offside goal.
Mm-hmm.
Although, did I see some dithering about that? I'm not sure, but...
I didn't see anything with that particular goal. I think there was a shout in Atlanta for a disallowed offside goal. But I don't know about the Chicago-New York game. I didn't see that one.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Chicago got close a couple of times, but they really didn't have the same... I think it's the fact they were in the knockout round in the first place was because they got into the situation where they just lacked the same form and sort of fire. What you were talking about, that exciting quality that they had earlier in the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've just seemed to have petered out a little bit, and certainly I think that a lot of people would have thought New York were the favorites in that game, but to put on such a master class and... You know, where New York has been up and down, one of their players that has not been up and down is Kleshtin. And,
yeah.
I think, you know, again, a performance that just proves his worth. Not to take anything away from the rest of the team that put in solid performances, but I agree that Chicago has a lot of stars, New York has a lot of stars, and the difference was New York stars showed up to the match and performed, and Chicago just looked utterly... Like, they almost looked embarrassed at points. Like, they just didn't have any idea of what to do and kind of looked like they hadn't played New York all season. And I think it's a very, very fair result. Oh, by the way, the penalty for Houston was waived off after video review. So there'll be lots to talk about on the next episode, I'm sure.
It got VAR'd.
Got VAR'd hard. So the second game of on Wednesday, that's October 25th, it's very hard to keep track of the schedule. I'm amazed that we can, let alone anyone else. But was Vancouver versus San Jose. And they were coming in, having just played San Jose a week prior, and that game ending in a 2-2 result, which... And then, of course, San Jose playing Minnesota in a last-minute challenge, and I think we talked about it, of just San Jose really coming together and finding the answers to get themselves into the playoffs, and in true MLS form, in a way that nobody could possibly predict, Vancouver blows them out 5-0.
This is exactly what the Whitecaps needed. I think that it was a really tough run in for them. The fact that the Whitecaps did not get first was a real momentum killer. But I think we were talking last week about the fact that this is the knockout round is an opportunity to jumpstart yourself somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and you know, it was. I think Vancouver knew what they had to do going in. We know Carl Robinson's a very shrewd manager, and he was going to have a plan. He knew that his team should have beat San Jose the game they played prior to this against them. But, I mean, the interesting thing is that for the first half, it still did look a little cagey. And, like, it may not open up for the Caps. But, you know, quite apart from them just doing all the fundamentals really, really well, the thing that opened it up was bringing Nicholas Mesquita on. And a couple of key changes where all of a sudden they just look like a different team. And I don't think it's an argument for having Mesquita on earlier. I think he's served that that super sub role very, very well over the last couple of years. That Mesquita brings an element of creativity to the attack that somebody like Hurtado might not necessarily do. Hurtado's got speed, and he's going to, you know, give the defense something to worry about. But with Mesquita, he can play in so many different positions, and he's just a more creative player that you're really not sure where he's going to slot in. And it seemed like, almost from the first touch of the ball, that he was just completely locked in and came out with something to prove, which is very, very positive for the Whitecaps going forward.
I think so as well. We can get to this a little bit later, but there is a possibility that Yuri Reyna and Christian Jeter will not be available.
Mm-hmm.
To the Whitecaps. So, as much as Mesquita does benefit a little bit from that super sub role, and you can't have a clearer case for yourself than the one that he put forth in that game, scoring the brace so quickly, there may be more work for him to do in the second leg against Portland.
I hope so. I feel like he's... I don't know. I don't know if hard done by is the right phrase. I think he's done himself proud over the course of the season. I feel like he probably could have used a few more minutes. But of course, it's one of those awkward things where, you know, if he was a left winger, then maybe he would have more chances. But unfortunately, where he slots in, he's really usually playing in either Reyna, Bolaños, or Teixeira's spot. And as we've seen this season, like, it's very hard to put somebody above those three players.
I feel like we always get into this cycle with Mesquita, where Mesquita has a very good performance. And the last time I can remember this happening is the away match to Montreal in the league. He has a great performance, and everybody says, wow, why don't we play Mesquita more? And then we don't hear a lot from Mesquita for a while, whether or not it's the player themselves or just not getting minutes. And then all of a sudden there's another little outburst like this, and everybody says, wow, why don't we play Mesquita more?
And it's difficult as a coach because you're always going to face that criticism, right? Is that you've got good players. But, you know, I think, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but a case in point was yesterday's game against Seattle. That's the third game in a row that Alphonso Davies hasn't even made the bench. This is a very competitive team, and just because results haven't necessarily gone our way in the last five or six games, with the exclusion of the blowout against San Jose at home, doesn't mean that there's not extreme competition for places. And it's easy to say, well, Mesquita did this and Mesquita did that, but a good coach knows where their players can slot in. And again, the thing I like about Mesquita, he's always sort of that wild card. Like, putting him in as a sub, people don't know what he's going to do. And I think that's what is so effective. I think if you start Mesquita all the time, people start to figure out what he's about, as we've seen against Kakuta Mane, as we've seen against Alphonso Davies. Like, they're electric players, but defenses can figure them out. And if you have the right formation, it's actually not all that hard to shut them down. But a player like Mosquito, who's got the creativity and, you know, brings something a little bit different to it, he's the kind of player that you want to be able to put on in the 30th, or sorry, in the 60th or the 70th minute to just bring a little bit of the unknown factor.
And I definitely agree with that. I think we can talk a little bit about the... we can, instead of jumping back and forth with the Whitecaps, why not just talk about the Seattle game?
Sure.
There has been a lot of debate, and I'm not sure how to feel about this, about it was a 0-0 draw.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a whole lot in it. There were a couple... each team had a couple shots on goal, shots on goal. I remember one, I can't remember who from Vancouver it was, late, had it, but Seattle also had that that chance that was somehow cleared by Kendall Waston, despite knocking it off the crossbar.
Yeah.
Trying to clear trying to clear his own goal. People have been complaining about the defensive, if not the defensive nature, then what they see is kind of a lack of ambition in terms of goal scoring in that match, or a decision to go out and win, because I think it was a combined one shot on goal.
Yeah.
Which is the lowest ever, because that's not great.
Doesn't go much lower than that.
When I was mentioning the Alex Bono save, or the save later on. Mm. Not Bono, I'm thinking of a different team. Fry.
Yeah.
What do you think about you? I believe you were there. No, you weren't there. You weren't at the San Jose game, but you were here.
Yeah.
What did you think of the display?
Yeah, I had to miss the San Jose game because I was traveling, although I did get to see it in the end. Not live. Well, yes, live, but not there in person. And I was there last night when we're recording this for the Seattle game. It was very frustrating as a fan, although I feel like this role, doing this podcast, has helped a little bit because I did not lose my voice until the 90th minute. I yell a lot less at games, I feel like, because I'm trying to pay attention to what's going on. I think I probably had different feelings leaving the stadium last night and talking to the folks that I share season's tickets with. And I think we were probably a little bit more focused on individual performances and things that I thought could have been better, or we thought could have been better. But after hearing Carl Robinson's post-game speech, or not speech, press conference thinger, I think he summed it up pretty well. And sometimes Carl Robinson can speak in code a little bit, or he's very repetitive and says the same things, but at the same time, I feel like he can be rather transparent, which was this idea of the chess game came up again and again and again, and I think we saw that play out. And it did not make for a spectacular game to watch, nor did it make for a very good result. However, I think Carl Robinson actually had a really quite, again, shrewd approach to this game, which was, do not concede at home. Because now they can go to Seattle and play their game and do whatever they want to do. They have nothing to lose. People did not expect them to get this far and have written them off. They don't have a fully fit squad. But a 0-0 result means that now everything hinges on this game in Seattle. And I think that's an okay place to be for the Whitecaps. As we've seen, they've beaten the best defensive side in MLS, in Sporting Kansas City, away, which very few teams have done. They've been a great away team. And yeah, we know what happened with the last Seattle game, but I thought it was a gamble for sure, and it was frustrating to watch. And I think there was definitely calls that should have probably gone the other way, and maybe would have resulted in a few of those set pieces that the Whitecaps love so much. But I also feel like Brian Schmetzer rolled the dice a little bit, and that clearly the instructions were given for his team to go down and waste time and see this game out. Seattle really wasn't trying to get an away goal either. Like, they were just content to wait and see what the other team would do, and if something opened up, either team would take the chance, but otherwise they were just going to kick the ball around and try to feel each other out a little bit. The difference is now Seattle needs to be very, very disciplined at home. And if you have a chance, you should watch the video where a reporter suggests that Seattle doesn't foul much, which statistically is true, but just watch Carl Robinson's expression. And I think watch the highlights from yesterday and you'll see why he had that expression, because somehow Kendall Waston came out of the game with a black eye and his eye swollen shut, but this is the team that concedes the fewest fouls. I think that Schmetzer is opening himself up to a real, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it's going to be a battle. And now it's in people's heads, and it's going to be in the referees' heads about the fact that so few fouls were called in that game. And the Whitecaps have an opportunity to do something different, which they have struggled to do in many of the last few years, which is play a bit of a dirty game. And Seattle hit the pitch at about just every opportunity, especially in the last 30 minutes. You know, Nuhu calling for a sub. He knew there wasn't any subs left. He's down on the pitch. He's in agony. And then as soon as it's made aware to him that there's no subs left, he springs back up to his feet and can't wait to get back on and finishes the game completely fine. I know adrenaline kicks in and all those kinds of things, but it was it was just so obvious that he had received instructions to go down and waste time. And I think this could come back to bite Seattle in that Carl Robinson, I know, has communicated to his players to stay on their feet and to not go down easily. But away in Seattle, you have to think, especially if Bolaños is fit, even for 60 minutes, he's going to be getting into all kinds of space, and he's going to be waiting for that challenge coming from behind. And I think that they've set themselves up well for this one, in that people will be looking for the Seattle fouls because they go down so easily. I think the Whitecaps are going to do the same. Now, they could cancel each other out and it just means the ref is going to wave play on, but I think that Vancouver is going to play a very tactical game again, and I think they're going to be looking to win those fouls, and I think a few could go their way.
I think that people talk, you've seen Vancouver over the years, obviously when Blas Perez played for Vancouver, there was a certain amount of that going on. It's weaved its way in and out of the game.
Yeah.
A little bit. You don't see it happen that often because it is highly criticized by the fan base, but if you think the game getting a little tougher, I can't say that would hurt the Whitecaps. I think that you have this. I had this thought after hearing that connecting me to discussion of the NWSL final, which was also very like the game plan from the Portland Thorns was very physical, and Jonathan Tannenwald of the Philadelphia. Oh, I can't remember the name of the Philadelphia paper, but he said, when comparing that 1-0 game to this the Toronto game, he said, sorry, the MLS Cup final, he said, we're in the age of bad finals. And I wonder if, like, high-stakes soccer has gotten incredibly defensive and risk-averse. Do you think that's the case, or do you think it's kind of more of an isolated incident?
I think in MLS, the opposite would prove to be true. I think occasionally you see it, and... I definitely think the opposite is true of global soccer. And we've talked about this a little bit, is that teams are looking to attack and be creative. And so when we see a game like what happened on Sunday against Vancouver and Seattle, we tend to want to say, oh, well, it wasn't very exciting, and this team should have done this, and this team should have done this. But it was a tactical game. It was two managers who lined up against each other and probably wanted to cancel each other out. It sucks if that happens every game, but, you know, 5-6 years ago, that was the golden standard for European teams, is you look to defend, and just wait for your opening opportunity, and then knock in a goal. In the era of globalized soccer and wanting to see these big, spectacular matches, you see teams taking way more risks going forward. I think it says a lot about both teams that they were able to lock down their back lines and put on very strong defensive performances. And credit where credit is due. I'll make my biases known if people haven't figured out already. But all credit to Seattle's back line. I thought, aside from Nuhu going down way too easily a number of times to kill time, they didn't put a foot wrong. I mean, Chad Marshall was where he needed to be, and Roman Torres was a monster again. Like, they did all the same things that the Whitecaps' back line did, and they were just switched on. And as a fan, it's not the most exciting thing to watch, but as a former defender and as a fan of the game, there were challenges and positionings on both sides that I thought a lot of people were still applauding.
Yeah, I think that I heard the complaint that, you know, you open up the entire lower bowl and fit 27,000 in there, which is, I think, one of the highest MLS era attendances. And don't put on a show is a complaint that I've heard, but at the same time, it's the playoffs. It's not a showroom. It's the goal is to get results and continue your season. Yeah. And I can't think anybody that watches the Whitecaps hasn't remembered being carved open by Seattle at one point or another.
Exactly.
When you're not careful.
Well, and it also depends on what's your show, right? I thought that De Jong and Nerwinski had absolute standout performances, the best they've played all season. And they both made mistakes, and they both recovered from them well. And so again, it's you know, everybody wants to see goals, and they want to see the ball moving in the opposite direction from their goal, and they want to see exciting plays. But I don't think it can be overstated how good of a game that back line had. And, you know, yeah, it's frustrating to see Chani give up the ball so easily or win the ball and then kick it to the opposing side. However, point out, like, Laba kind of did the same thing, and it's winning the first tackle but not the second tackle. But overall, the team was very, very switched on. I thought Ghazal had a fantastic game as well. Mistakes here and there, but not any more than any of what you would consider, I mean, A, better players, and B, much higher paid players on Seattle. I thought Lodero was basically neutered the whole game by a very, very switched on backline and midfield that read his number. And it's not always going to be pretty and it's not always going to be exciting, but I do think the tactics work to their advantage. The question is now, can they go to Seattle and take the game to them and win some of those fouls? But also, they need to play a little bit dirtier against Seattle. Seattle's been very, very crafty in the way that they've conceded so few fouls. They certainly commit the same amount of fouls.
The teams that are in their destiny, if they are to progress to this playoff bracket, are very talented, very competent, and at times when you see the Whitecaps lose, you see this kind of like just sadness,
yeah,
on their faces. You know, this lack of confidence, this like, you know, this inability to, like, you know, figure out why a superior opponent is taking them apart. And if they're going to, if they're going to be able to progress, they're going to have to match that competitive fire that you do see animate a player like Clint Dempsey.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to be interesting with the potential omission of Reyna and Teixeira.
It's interesting. I feel like maybe people are a little too hard on Carl Robinson at the moment. But I don't know how much this is a factor generally in MLS, but I think that anything could be dealt with a grain of salt.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and fans in the modern game are a fickle bunch, and everybody thinks they can do better. I think. Yeah, if it's your home team, you're always going to be frustrated. But I can't imagine a very different conversation is happening in Seattle right now with Brian Schmetzer. And, you know, the thing I was thinking about earlier is that in this age of MLS, when people are like, you know, oh, do you trust Carl Robinson or not? And what's going to happen? And do you think he can really do this? I'm like, my question is always, who replaces him? In an era where Bruce Arena and Ziggy Smith are fired, who replaces Carl Robinson? And you can talk about, okay, he hasn't developed young players enough, and he doesn't play Canadians enough, and, you know, he tinkers too much with the lineup, but you go, statistically speaking, and looking what he's achieved, he is one of the best coaches in MLS, regardless of age. So, you know, it's all fine and well to criticize a coach, and, you know, if you pay for tickets, I believe you deserve the right to criticize the coach and the team wherever necessary, but keep it in perspective. Like, Carl Robinson does things that makes us scratch our heads, as does any coach, but he's there for a reason, and the Whitecaps are where they are for a reason. And I'm still a firm believer in results. And I still firmly believe that Seattle is far and away a better team than Vancouver. We held them 0-0 at home. So we have to go to Seattle, open up the game, attack like crazy, and play a little dirty and beat Seattle at their own game. It's simple, but it's going to be difficult. But an exciting prospect.
You can criticize the fact that you can criticize the idea of whether or not opportunities were missed or promise wasn't got to, but I think that you really have to look at what were the goals and did you achieve the goals? And I said, this was my thought on the final positioning, is that third place was great.
Yeah.
And if they are able to be successful in Seattle and progress through, I don't think anybody is going to look back and be like, oh, but they didn't play the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Results rule.
Yeah.
The other thing,
I don't know, are we just old fashioned in believing that, of like, They're like, well, it's not the right way to do things. Like, yeah, but they're... Look at the teams who did, quote-unquote, the right things who didn't even make the playoffs. So...
It's a once burned, twice shy situation where everything year after year, well, I don't know if it's fair to exactly go back this far, but for the Whitecaps, things go back to the fact that you see other teams in the league spend more on players.
Yeah.
So when I don't think with the level of people that point out that this is, you know, who call this negative play, I wouldn't dismiss all of their concerns, but ultimately the type of free-flowing attacking football that people desire costs money.
Yeah. And, you know, and they're in with a shout, and maybe that's okay.
Maybe that's okay. The one note I have left on Vinker or Seattle before we take off on it is that amazing photo of Ali Ghazal hauling off two players in headlocks.
I haven't seen that.
May get him a visit from Disco, apparently.
Oh, no.
No punishment at the time, but I'm seeing a report from Ari Lillenwall of MLSsoccer.com that says that Schmetzer was told that.
Mm.
It's a great picture. I highly recommend it.
I'm gonna have to look that up. No, I don't know. I think, yeah. Best not to go there. I had some helpful advice that I had to communicate to the referees at the end of last night's game, but, you know, neither here nor there. The thing I want to get to, we talked briefly about this before the show, but I think we can quickly touch on Houston versus Sporting KC. And yeah, if you could just sum it up in a word, what would that word be?
It would be the surname of the Houston goalkeeper whose name is...
I don't know.
Derek. Tyler Derek.
Oh, yeah, Derek. Yes. Well done, sir. Well done. Also, perhaps, if you want to talk about boring playoff games, that might have been it. Yeah.
It was unfortunate that it came off, and we're kind of we'll talk about it in a second, but compared to the game that immediately preceded Atlanta Columbus, it lacked the fire for sure.
Sure. And we're also setting it up against three games in which the first two games there was 9 goals between them, and the second game went to penalty kicks. So it was all, you know, they had their work to do in terms of entertainment value, to be fair.
Yes. I think I was earlier talking about it as a 0-0. Well, it was 0-0 through full time. That's what I was giving it credit for. Which, ultimately, a draw through full time, not being able to carry it through, is my entire critique of the Sporting Kansas City season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was some... We've talked. Sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No. It was a very, very. It was late into, or no, it was early into the extra time period, but they weren't able to. Nobody came up with any better ideas throughout extra time.
No, and similarly could have been just a kind of tactical choice, but it was interesting to see that, you know, Houston has been pretty defensively sound all season. But as we've talked about, Sporting KC just really lacked any ideas going forward yet again. And some fantastic defensive plays. But you really had to feel like Houston was always going to win this one. And I know that a lot of people feel hard done by, but for me, the result seems quite fair. It also seems fair that the eventual goal did go to Albert Elise and the kind of season he's been having and the fact that a Houston team that has struggled at many, many points and, you know, at least hasn't always had the final finish, but is a promising young player, certainly I think has a lot more finish than some of the other players in his age range and of his caliber.
And Houston is managing to hold their own still through 50 minutes with Portland.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I'm following the hashtag, so it's mostly just a lot of really angry Timbers fans. I'm not sure that they have Twitter in Houston, at least judging by this Twitter feed, but...
The one thing I wanted to say... a great note about this this Houston-Portland game is that Sebastian Blanco was ruled out because of pouring hot water on his foot and burning it.
What?
Yes.
Oh, God. And apparently Char is out now with a fractured foot.
Uh-oh.
For different reasons, I think. But who knows?
He didn't do soup wrong.
He didn't do Supra. Oh, no. MLS, why must you constantly be a parody of yourself? Okay, I think we need to talk about, well, two games, but I feel like really only one is that important. Which is, can we just talk about Atlanta and Columbus? And I apologize to anybody who follows those two clubs and has waited until this point, because I feel like that was actually the most exciting match of the playoffs, and to me is the game to beat in the playoff series, like the one with the most drama and chances and emotion and everything else that comes with it. This was the playoff game that I thought, like, this is, if Don Garber really wants to build a market, look at these two teams.
Yeah. It was insane. I think that as a... It sucks that this seems to be what we keep talking about, because I think that trying to defend a 0-0 draw is this, like, state of being a little defensive of what people's criticisms are.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't think that necessarily you need to run out and have this critique all the time. But this game was definitely an exciting 0-0 draw through extra time or through full time until the shootout. Even without the shootout, which was a incredibly unique shootout.
Yeah. In so many ways.
I think that there was a lot of chances. The crowd was on point for it. I believe the attendance was at 67, so not as high as it could have been, but I believe breaking the playoff record.
Sure. When we're criticizing a playoff crowd for only being 67,000. Yeah.
Perhaps. I thought it was really great. You had two clubs that really had something to fight for and that were obviously going at it full tilt, which was my critique of a lot of the teams heading into the end of the playoffs, is it didn't seem like they had that intensity. But this game definitely had intensity. I think that... do we want to talk about the shootout a little bit? Because you had a lot of successive saves that Atlanta just was not able to dig out from underneath.
Yeah, I mean... I totally agree. I think this was the game where you saw, before the PKs, a 0-0 result is very exciting, that both teams came out and wanted it and gave the best that they could give. But I felt somewhat vindicated in sort of defending Columbus all season long, and it really had nothing to do with the ownership issues up until that point. But admittedly, I was on my feet cheering for Columbus during this game because of that. But in the penalty kicks, I just, like, it doesn't matter what you think or the result, but just Stefan is a goalkeeper and he's 22 years old. And this is really not the role that he was brought in to do. And he stopped the first two with a maturity and a talent that I think far exceeds the Tim Howards and the Nick Raimondos of the league. And if that does not instill fear in other teams, I don't know what will. But I feel like watching Stefan in that final 30 minutes in the PKs, I just went, like, this kid is headed to Europe. They're not going to be able to keep him. He's got fantastic instincts, and he waits so long, in a good way, to read the direction of a kick. I mean, he's so switched on to what needs to happen as a goalkeeper. I thought that, to me, so far, that's been the standout performance of the playoffs, is that he just, you know, of course you always want to say instinct or whatever, but I feel like there's a lot of preparation and a lot of work that he's done, and yeah, combined with a bit of magic on that PK that hit the post, but to save two against two very good strikers, goalkeepers of much older vintage and much more experience would be very happy with one of those saves. The fact that he made two was no mistake. I think he's the real deal. And a great for the kid, Adam John, to get the go-ahead goal and win it for them. And another young prospect. But I don't think anybody's confused about who that match really belongs to, and that's Stefan.
I think that I read a book on penalty kicks earlier this year, and one of the standout moments of it, of the shootout from a shootoutology perspective, is that if you crunch the numbers, goalies underrepresent the amount of times that shooters shoot through the middle. So goalies don't stay in the center enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's roughly even. I think.
Interesting.
The percentage, they could definitely stay in the center more. And what you had was Federico Higuain scoring through the middle, and everybody saying, "Wow, what a gutsy move to do that," on commentary. And then immediately, Leandro González Pires steps up and takes it right down the center, and Stefan stays right there.
Yeah.
Which I think is maybe a function of that ability to read the ball that you were talking about.
Yeah, and ultimately, it's the most difficult, but in some ways the simplest job to do, in that if you let too much of the trends of the game and things like that get inside your head, you're going to play in a certain way. And I mean, Stefan just has no business being as confident as he is waiting for that ball to come. It's like he can't wait for the striker to release the ball and kick it in the most difficult place or try to outsmart him. But he's just so, so calm and reads it so well. That to me was the takeaway, right? I just thought, like, this is the player we need to watch here, regardless of what happens in Columbus, and hopefully it works out for them and the supporters. But Stefan has a bright future ahead of him. He's just the maturity of reading the ball, and in that same kind of situation, as I said, we've seen much older, much more experienced keepers really just, quite frankly, shit the bed on those kinds of plays. And he did not look troubled. He looked like he expected it to go to PKs. And I mean, it's almost boring to talk about because he looked so calm. You see, he just stepped up and waited and waited and waited. And I imagine the coaching staff had him reviewing a lot of tapes as well. But ultimately, with a goalkeeper, sometimes it just comes down to you have to feel it out. And there can be too much in your head. You just have to wait and see and watch what the player is going to do and the way that their feet move and make a decision. And you can watch all the tape you want in the world, but to me, that has still been the play or the plays of the playoffs, is Stefan's response to that PK situation. And as well, again, Autumn John to just tuck it away. It's good to see another young kid that, you know, nobody really knows anything about, just step up and calmly slot at home.
That makes a lot of sense. If Stefan does want to have an expanded role with the U.S. men's national team, he's got a little bit too much hair on the top of his head. known for their bald-headed goalkeepers down there in the United States.
Well, maybe it's time for a change. Haircut and otherwise.
In the narrative department, a lot of people were talking about Atlanta when they started toppling attendance records. And it is unfortunate that it's unfortunate for them that this, you know, Save the Crew is what they're talking about on commentary the entire game. And it must hurt really bad to be in this position, but I think Atlanta has had an amazing first season, as well as you could have hoped, and a great foundation to build on.
It's been incredible. And we really haven't seen it before, and like, money helps for sure, but they've put together the right ingredients to make it work for them, and they've challenged a lot of very, 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 very good teams this season. And you know, it's virtually unheard of to have an expansion team even make the playoffs, let alone challenge. And that's why I liked this matchup so much, is because I thought, you know, Atlanta had such an electric season, but also one that was kind of up and down, and they fought their way in, and so did Columbus. And so it made sense for the two to play each other early on, rather than having, you know, I feel like either team play a team of lesser competition. I feel like if you were watching Atlanta versus Sporting KC or Houston versus Columbus, we wouldn't quite get the same excitement and value, really.
No. This was the right matchup with the right teams at the right time to create something special. And you never know who and how are going to create these situations are going to get created. Certainly nobody really predicted Toronto-Montreal in the conference finals last year.
Mm-hmm.
To have both to get in there and to have that phenomenal the phenomenal performances that they did have. I think that it would be nice to see, you're right that it sets a bar for other teams to sort of meet. One of the challenges other teams have that we've talked about before is how to break down TFC.
Mm-hmm.
And in their opening first leg match, New York kind of looked like they maybe had that down.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit. It seemed for a while, Toronto scored early, which certainly is a little demoralizing, but I think that New York hung in there when they were able to win the penalty kick at the end of the first half. That was the exact right moment to do it. And certainly Toronto with two away goals doesn't bode great for them, but they have put themselves in a good... I feel like they have demonstrated, as they did in the earlier playoff game, the potential that we believe the New York Red Bulls to be able to have.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a fair result, and the Giovinco free kick kind of says it all about their season. You know, he also picks up a needless yellow card as well, and so who knows what happens there. We know Toronto can play without him if need be.
That was incredibly pretty. It went short side, and they had a New York had a defender on the near post.
Yeah, okay, but can I also point out that Teixeira's free kick against San Jose was better? Can we just say that? It was further away and was placed far better. Giovinco is still a better player. I just want to point that out for people.
Best
free kick of the playoffs goes to Teixeira. Just saying.
Toronto and Giovinco have become known for these free kicks, so a lot of people were, I think, giving Teixeira his due when they had that beautiful free kick of being like, hey, Giovinco, take a look at this.
Yeah.
One concern that I did have is we've talked a little bit about the team being able to pick up without Giovinco.
Mm-hmm.
But almost more concerning to me is injuries that were picked up by Drew Moore, who went out while conceding a penalty, who apparently will be good. He says he just sort of tested it at halftime, knew he couldn't continue, had to come out at halftime. Right, he didn't go out right after the penalty, but he got out at halftime, which I guess was. And then said he was feeling better. But Victor Vasquez, who said he was hit in the midsection and pain grew over the course of the game, may be missing for a little bit longer. And I think those two players are definitely key, important players when you talk about the back line of Toronto FC and also their attacking engine.
Mm-hmm. Well, in many ways, I feel like Vasquez is more important there. So.
I think that when Moore was having his heart issues, I know there's like an emotional thing where everybody's a little worried because they want him to pull through.
Yeah, of course.
I think once he sort of regained his health, it did help form a little bit because they were tougher. It was harder for Toronto in the beginning of the season. But Vasquez is really... inserted himself as a key part of the offense so far this year. And I think that it's, while we've been thinking of our, like, what are our Toronto permutations in terms of who can beat them and what happens if they're put in X situations, a slew of key injuries like this is not something I think that has been considered that clearly, but maybe, in fact, a weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's entirely possible. So, I mean, there's no good way to approach this schedule because everything is just happening so damn fast. And we've got Columbus and New York City playing tomorrow night, and Thursday we've got Seattle and Vancouver playing each other. But we've got a few games left before the next matchups, and so I feel like it's only apt that we just make some predictions. And let's try to go with our guts here.
I'll also look, just because I'm amused by it, at Stephen Goff, soccer insider from Washington Post, that says, you're tweeted, no rhyme, no reason, MLS playoff schedule. Saturday, no matches. Sunday, one. Monday, two. Tuesday, one. Wednesday, yeah. Zero. Thursday, one. Friday, zero. Saturday, zero. Sunday, three.
It's the worst. I just saw this tweet about the Houston-Portland match, and I feel like this summarizes how most people feel about it.
Does the MLS actually care about the MLS Cup playoffs? Horrible pitch, spotty attendance, and boring two-leg soccer being played. I mean, a little unfair, but also I get it on a Monday night.
It's hard with the two legs because people... It's hard with the two legs because people do approach the first leg expecting some sort of entertainment value, but sure. First legs suck.
People hear playoffs and they're like, ooh, exciting, and then they realize... However, I don't know. I mean, hockey, it's like it's over 7 games, so who gives a shit, really? It's like we're at... If you win 4 games over 3 games, I don't really see who's the winner in that case, but different audiences. Columbus versus New York City, that's happening tomorrow night. Make a prediction here. What do you think? What's going to happen there?
And who's hosting? Columbus is.
Mm-hmm.
Columbus 1, New York City 0.
Hmm, interesting.
Columbus is able to at home, hopefully in front of a sold-out stadium, hold off the key New York players heading into, heading into Yankee Stadium. And is able to snatch one themselves on the counter and move forward, or they did not move forward, but try to get into the second leg in a power position.
Hmm.
What do you think?
I'm gonna say 2-1 Columbus. I think New York can get a goal. I think they're a little bit more creative, but I think. Honestly, they've got to be a bit surprised about where they are for not a fantastic season. But, I still feel like this is Columbus's to win. I think New York, if they take some risks, could win it. But, I feel like the tide is against them. I feel like Columbus takes this one.
I honestly kind of feel like New York takes the series, but doesn't win in this game.
Hmm. Yeah, very possible as well. I think I agree.
Because as much as it would be hard fought, and it should be hard fought in Columbus, you also have the issue of there are just too many players. New York's attack is too potent. David Villa is too potent to be held off the scored sheet forever. And that's a slightly different challenge than the one that Atlanta has posed.
Yeah, potentially. Checking back in Houston versus Portland in the 75th minute. Nothing's happening. Still 0-0.
I think that maybe we've... Houston has lucked into some scenario where they completely drain out games when they're at home, but manage to win or get good results. I would say that even if the result stands as it does, I think that Portland takes it.
Hmm. Interesting.
On November 5th. In the second leg.
Even with the number of injuries, include like 3 forced injuries in this game?
Well, I guess if Chara is out, that's true. I was expecting Blanco to get back from his soup hurt. I'm sorry, it's bad. It hurts to burn yourself. It's not fun.
Don't be sorry, but just also like, you know, maybe get somebody else to do that during the playoffs. Okay, we're talking predictions here, so we've talked Columbus versus New York FC. The one that we maybe don't want to predict, Vancouver versus Seattle in Seattle. What's your prediction?
Oh, I wanted you to do it first, because I was hoping you were going to predict Vancouver, and I wasn't going to sound like a negative Nancy.
Okay. Do you want me to do it then?
a negative gender-free individual.
Okay. Here's my call.
Yes.
If Vancouver can be as tactically minded as they were at home, there's a way in which Vancouver wins this. It's 0-0, so this game means everything. Which I think is what probably both coaches planned for. Seattle is going to come out flying. We know what Dempsey can do. A lot depends on available players. And maybe I'm just hoping that I'm going to, like, reverse jinx this. I'm going to say Vancouver 1-0 wins it.
I think that, obviously, a tactical plan was applied in the first half to achieve the desired result, which it did. Unfortunately, that does only particularly matter if you can win the tie. And when Seattle are on, they're on. And playing at home in the second leg of the... Playing at home for everything in front of their fans... I'm not feeling... I'm usually an Optimist Union guy, and I'm not against doing what you had to get into this situation. So I'm actually not negative on how the first half went, but I'm more concerned, I would say.
Hmm.
Maybe not.
It's
as
not
much as there are weaknesses in through potential injuries, those weaknesses are not to the back line.
I'm not concerned. It's also that Vancouver has nothing to lose here, and I feel like Seattle has a bit of a chip on their shoulder about needing to win this. But Vancouver really doesn't need to win this, and I think Carl Robinson's already shown this includes the game in Kansas, is just go out and play the game. Honestly, now, it really is just a go out and do what you need to do to try to win the game. And not in a cliche way, but expect to see, I think, a Vancouver side that is either able to rise to the occasion or not. But if they're able to rise to the occasion, they're going to give Seattle something to worry about that I don't think other teams have been able to. That nobody expected Vancouver to come this far. They have. And this is a team they play a lot. They know a lot about. And I think if you're Carl Robinson, the thing that they have to do in this game is... really just put out the best starting 11 that you can and play your counter-attacking game. The last time they were in Seattle, they tried to control more of the ball and they just got completely destroyed. But again, different personnel are available, so who knows what happens, but... there's different players available, and as Robinson said today, like it could take somebody to step up and play the hero. But if I'm remembering correctly, also there was a different person in goal in that game.
You've talked me into it. I think that for the people that were mad at the two teams in the first leg for not doing anything of note to earn themselves an advantage. I think it's going to rest on the shoulders of who can stand out under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was watching the first leg, I saw that Freddie Montero was really up for it. I could see an intensity in him that he was... very committed to be playing against his former club, very determined to get the desired result. And I'm going to go Whitecaps get 40% of the possession and win 1-0 with the Montero goal.
Good to know. Also throw in here, part of this is built into a little bit of superstition, in which yesterday I ran into my very dear, close, personal friend, Jay DeMeritt, at halftime. And he shook my hand heartily, and I'm just going to take that as a sign. It didn't help us yesterday, but I'm going to take it as a preemptive sign that we win this game.
Very good.
Jay DeMeritt is fully invested in the outcome of this playoff match, which makes me feel better already.
Good luck, Jay. Good luck, Jay. Absolutely.
And then we have Toronto and New York Red Bulls on Sunday. I didn't see the game, but New York has it to sort of... They've got their backs up against the wall. What, do you have a prediction there?
If they could have seen out the first leg 1-1, I think they could have had a chance here. I don't see them... I do not see them scoring twice and not conceding. In fact, I would say that would be the opposite. Toronto 2, New York Red Bull 0, and then 4-1 on aggregate. Not at that stadium, not this season, not in front, not with the potency that the team currently provides, and with two away goals.
Yeah, very fair. I don't know why, but I'm just gonna say this and hope that my wild prediction is right, and if it's not, then people will just be like, ah, you're dumb, but if it's right, I'll seem awesome. I think this one goes to penalties, and I think New York wins.
Oh, you know, New York Red Bull is not a bad, a bad bet as that Portland-esque team that squeaks in at the very end and then somehow is able to put something together.
At the very least, and maybe this will help contextualize that prediction, is that do not write off New York Red Bulls. There's a lot of things wrong with the team. There's a lot of things that they've not gotten right this season. But don't write them off. There's a little bit of magic beneath this team. And I think it's a very fair matchup to have them against Toronto. And I think we even saw tonight that... You know, as good as a side as Toronto is, New York is ready for the challenge, I think. And as good as a challenge will be given to them. Part of me, admittedly, is just a little bit hopeful for a playoff picture that just looks different from last year, of what does it mean to have New York go through instead of Toronto. Yeah. I think Greg Vanney is going to get under the skin of his players, and they know what they have to do. But again, and New York Red Bulls, I see, is another team that, like, they really have nothing to prove and have been up and down all season long again. But they do just seem to have that extra bit of magic on occasion. Maybe it's not Toronto magic, but it's Clushton magic, which has proved fruitful this season. Right? No? Did you die? What's happening? You disappeared on me, mate. We were so close. No! Andrew.
Hello, it's me. Oh, hello.
There Hi. We go. Okay. That was good. It was just a long, eventful pause, and it was kind of at a good point. I mean, that's it. That's it. We have to wait until Monday to really find out what's going to happen.
Yes, with both. Yeah, absolutely. Or both with the, both with this call and with the result. No, I definitely think that, you have always been on the side that there is a possibility for this team to get beaten. And I don't think you're wrong. If I don't know that New York Red Bulls are the team to do it, but I think that it's not impossible.
It's and I also leave myself the escape route of the fact that Toronto has been fantastic and the best side in MLS ever. So if they do win, I can just be like, well, I mean, that just shows you how good they are. But I think that there's a way still. I just have that feeling that this is not their year again.
That makes sense. I have some news. There is some news.
Mm-hmm.
That came out today that I found particularly interesting, which is that in the Save the Crew saga, which is continuing, mm-hmm. One particularly interesting thing that's happened is that the county judge in San Antonio, where Toyota Stadium was built, is asking district court to look into this situation because they thought they had basically had an agreement with Major League Soccer, or at least they had said, you know, we don't want Austin to get in if we're going to get in. And they were assured that that would not happen. So they went ahead and built this stadium. However, they're suggesting that the fact that Anthony Preckert had had a clause permitting him to move the team to Austin if certain conditions occurred,
mm-hmm.
or whatever form that clause took, San Antonio is suggesting that they were misled. And it all really comes down to this question that that people are sort of stepping around a little bit because things aren't always public, but I think people are questioning whether or not the events as they unfolded have ever really been done with a goal of keeping Columbus in Columbus, or keeping the Crew in Columbus, or preventing Precourt from moving them to Austin, or whether or not that was the final goal. It's hard to piece that together with evidence right now, but a lot of people are sort of making that supposition. And I think that this is the site of the county judge's discontent, is that if you said, and I think a big issue with the MLS expansion process altogether, which is if you said that we had to have a stadium to expand here, and we went and built you this stadium, but really your owner was planning to move to Austin the whole time, mm-hmm. that's not just, you know, shitty bargaining, but it might be something that a court might look into.
Yeah, and this is where I feel like people, I don't think many people forget that this league is still very young, and it is ultimately run by a bunch of cowboys who have no idea what the fuck they're doing. To put it bluntly, like, this league is in its infancy still, and they're trying to expand, and we've seen major successes, and we've seen a lot of gains across the league, but administratively, this league has no idea what it's doing and is making up things as they go along. And it's stories like these that just highlight it, right? And as we've seen, you know, with them trying to buy out the New York Cosmos as well.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, they're trying to do this major league move and really have a monopoly on the market and choke out any sort of local competition, but they don't really seem to have a plan going forward. Like, it's not even a good monopoly. It's just like a haphazard, well, we want to control the rights to everything and make sure we control this thing, but they don't really know what they want to do. I mean, even the fact that there's these bids going on, which seems like it should be fair, how does the league not know and identify its soccer markets and make a decision prior to that? of what will be the most economically viable.
How do any of these teams put together these bids and build stadiums sight unseen without, and then look at an owner that tried to sidestep the process by buying the club that paid the least to be in the league?
Yeah.
Or at least through expansion fees. Obviously, there was much more investment, but he didn't pay it. How do you think they look and how they feel being a part of this, you know, competitive horse race while somebody else waltzes in? You mentioned another important issue, which is the NASL second division sanctioning.
Mm-hmm.
Which they have lost to the USSF, and they're filing an injunction. They're filing an injunction against USSF, denying its sanctioning so that it can continue through the next season. The heart of their argument, I listened to a Howler podcast about this, is that there is a collusion that goes on between MLS and the U.S. Soccer Federation, and that, or a conspiracy, I can't remember the exact term. But the heart of their explanation of the ties is that Soccer United Marketing, the arm of the league that controls the league's rights and also controls the rights to U.S. soccer matches and some other high-profile international matches, is affiliated to the USSF and creates a situation in which the USSF is going to make decisions that benefit MLS because they're in business together when it comes to Soccer United Marketing,
mm-hmm.
which is MLS owned, which is an interesting idea on the face of it. And the people that I've heard talk about it are, you know, say that alone, it's not necessarily a huge idea, but there are strengths and weaknesses to that argument. But there was also the revelation from New York Cosmos owner Rocco Commisso that while the club was in its ownership crisis last winter, Soccer United Marketing was looking to purchase and close the Cosmos, which would have been a death blow for the league if that happened.
Yeah. I'm glad that there's not more antitrust laws in the U.S. I think things are working out really well with just a free, unregulated market. Seems to be serving everybody well.
It is tough because obviously the MLS was created as a vehicle to improve the fortunes of the U.S. men's program. But it's also a separate business, but it's not, but it is, but it's not.
And honestly, I think that what we're seeing is more incompetence rather than conspiracy of if they knew what the hell they were doing, it would probably make more sense, but they can't make up their minds what they're doing and that they wanted to expand men's U.S. soccer and then accidentally ended up with a league that started to make money and wasn't just a European retirement league. And now those two things are in contention with each other, and we're seeing the results of that play out in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah. I think that from a court perspective, it must have been, if you could say, oh, well, there's no way that this link, this Soccer United Marketing link, has anything to do with our decision-making process, and then they provide, if not the smoking gun, well, at least, you know, it puts the weak point of the USSF argument, or the weak point that the plaintiffs are attempting to strike at,
mm-hmm.
In focus.
Twew. All right, buddy. We need to rest up because there's a lot of games coming our way.
It's true. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online giving helpful advice to Seattle Sounders fans at That's So MLS. And where can we find you online?
You can find me at T Team Bates on Twitter. And you can also check out the fall issue of Haller at whatahaller.com. I would imagine that we'll check in with you again after this round of games and before the international period, listeners.
Indeed. Admittedly, the schedule is a little bit hard to follow, and so if the shows come up while a game is happening, and you're like, "Why? Why haven't you waited?" It's hard to schedule. This is West to East Coast here. This is our East to West Conference Final in a way. Just trying to schedule it like MLS matches. It's a bit of an ordeal. So we'll try to follow along as best we can.
We can tell you that nothing happened in the Houston-Portland game. It is over. It finished 0-0.
Yeah, that was a good call. I also want to point out that very early on into this evening, before we even started recording, and indeed that match had kicked off, Andrew was like, I don't feel like it's really going to be a factor in tonight's podcast if we record tonight. And I don't think it's one of those cases of the commentator's curse of, like, that's a game where Andrew called completely correctly. A lot of talk on Twitter, but I'm just going to hazard a guess without seeing any of the match that literally nothing happened. No one cares. The match occurred, but we'll just all move on and wait for the next one.
And in the meantime, until we, while we move on, don't get sent off.
My goodness. Good one, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, I need to eat some food. I'm starving.
Sleep.
You're a wonderful human being, and we will talk again soon.